This is the third part in a five-part interview series with Ilya Maslyansky on Russian internet manipulation. In this part, we will be talking about the Kremlin's online responses to internet dissent.
The other measure that you talked about is the online response. You listed two major tactics that the Kremlin uses to generate dissent. First, the first one is paid online trolls, and the second one is Twitter bots. I found your discussion on online trolling quite fascinating. Who are these trolls, and what do they do?
Well, this is definitely the most fun and exciting part of the research that I did. Yeah. And we mostly know about these internet trolls with the help of insider information, meaning that actual journalists, who mostly, I guess, worked for independent newspapers like Novaya Gazeta in Russia, they went essentially undercover to work for these so-called troll factories, to later expose and write news articles on those independent news media websites about what's going on inside. And, you know, some of them did it out of sheer adventurism. Some of them actually didn't believe that this was real and later found out that it was real and it was pretty scary. So this is, yeah, this is a great place sort of to dive into the discussion of these internet trolls. And internet trolling, Kremlin-sponsored internet trolling, constitutes an example of a third-generation internet control, because here, instead of directly limiting access, either for good or during specific times, the Kremlin sought to essentially start, I can't quite call it an online movement, but like an internet brigade. You know, there's been research done on that of the, you know, 50 Cent brigades in China. Something similar, you know, where people get paid to post stuff online that agrees with the official message of the state in order to compete with the opposition in cyberspace. And so these trolls are usually young people who, you know, just want to make a lot of extra money on the side, who undertook this very unusual and peculiar type of work. So imagine yourself, I don't know, walking around in St. Petersburg, and, you know, all of a sudden you see a posted note, essentially, that says that the Internet Research Agency is hiring online commentators and bloggers. And they pay people in cash. They pay people essentially under the table because they don't pay taxes, and they pay people quite a lot, more than most entry-level jobs in Russia would, probably more than any entry-level job would. And, you know, some out of sheer adventurism, some out of financial considerations, take up these jobs, go and sit in these offices all day long. And in a bit, I'll cover, you know, the information regarding what their average day looks like, because it is quite fascinating since they work like real-life factories.
As you said, you do draw from a number of different accounts by insiders and by journalists to describe the professional nature of the troll factories they used to work in. What's the average workday for one of these trolls?
To begin with, this whole trolling story became exposed when a journalist from Novaya Gazeta, one of Russia's leading independent newspapers, went undercover and did work for the Internet Research Agency, this is literally what it's called, in St. Petersburg, in their office. And later, the troll factory, as it is now called, moved to a bigger office in the St. Petersburg, you could call it a region or neighborhood of Olgino, which is, you know, where you get the phrase of trolls from Olgino. This has, you know, become essentially a name to refer to any kind of online trolling. So, and the Internet Research Agency, as of when I was doing my research, was a four-story building with various departments housed inside, which have amazing names, such as the bloggers department, the English department, where commentators would gather, and the English department, where trolls would pollute news websites like the BBC, New York Times, CNN, primarily the comments section underneath news articles. And as a side note, trolls who had command of the English language have traditionally been paid more than just, you know, trolls who can only troll in Russian. The commentators department, and the Ukrainian department, which was dedicated to posting and caricatures and all sorts of content about the Ukrainian political crisis. So any department, you name it, it's there. The trolls organize themselves in 12-hour shifts, which means that the agency works non-stop around the clock. There is people coming in and leaving every 12 hours. It is very secretive. They don't, you know, publicize who they are, don't have a website. And yet a lot of people work inside that four-story building. The trolls are tasked with producing topical posts that have to be produced daily. They have to reach various post and comments quotas per day. So one account that I read was published in Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. On their website, it was published by one of these people who went in on the inside and worked at the troll, that some people had to reach a quota of, I think, 135 comments per shift. And when you take that into a broader perspective, imagine tens of people writing 135 comments per shift, which happens twice a day, and polluting news websites. You know, at some point, it becomes difficult to tell what is truth and what is fiction. The trolls were also tasked, and I believe still are tasked, with using various keywords to make posts appear on search engines. So I guess it's a way to optimize these search engines, you know, and make them popular so that they would make it to potentially first or second page of a typical Google search. And a notable story, it's my absolute favorite story, is about a team of three, and we know of this story because one of the people who worked on the inside as a troll was one of this team of three, or this Russian troika. So this team of three were tasked with polluting municipal forums with pro-regime content from Kaliningrad on the Baltic Sea to Vladivostok on the Pacific Ocean. So essentially what they would do is they would log into a municipal forum. One of them would post something to disagree with the actions of the state to create an actual facade of believability and pluralism of opinion. And the other two would come to the rescue, to the status quo's rescue. They would come to its defense with links to newspaper articles, caricatures, pictures, and videos to discredit the fake opposition activists and make it look like the online community strongly backed the political establishment in the Kremlin.
That's very fascinating. On the one hand, you have this troll factory happening. You're using human labor to mass produce this misinformation. But on the other hand, it turns out that the Russians also use non-human algorithms to also manipulate information online. So I was also struck at how sophisticated the Kremlin's Twitter bot strategy became since the 2011 election, particularly during the Euromaidan crisis. Can you elaborate on this development?
Absolutely. Yeah. And to backtrack a little bit, Twitter bots were actually used by the Kremlin at the time of the 2011 parliamentary State Duma election. They were created in July of 2011 en masse, so almost half a year before the election in 2011. And in 2011, it's essentially like they were activated all at once to bombard the opposition on Twitter with pro-regime content and essentially distort and change the way in which the conversation about the parliamentary election was going. But it happened on an even broader and greater, wider scale after 2011. So as you mentioned, at the time of the Euromaidan crisis, which was happening in Ukraine, it began in November 2013. At the time, and we know this because a number of journalists, and primarily Lawrence Alexander, they really dug into this Russian Twitter bot campaign phenomenon and found things that are outright scary because of how sophisticated and covert these cyberspace pollution campaigns are and have become in recent years. Alexander uncovered thousands of Twitter accounts that followed one another in a closely knit network and posted pro-regime content online during key political events. For example, the Euromaidan crisis in November of 2013, or the assassination of Boris Nemtsov, a prominent opposition leader and an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin. In particular, Alexander found out that Twitter bot activity intensified in November 2013 and June 2014, which coincides with the beginning of the Euromaidan protests in Ukraine and the armed conflict between pro-Russian separatists and the Ukrainian government in eastern Ukraine, respectively. Scholars argue that this timing is by no means coincidental, because it has been and still is important for the Kremlin to have the Russians agree with the official message of the state with regards to what's been going on in the neighboring state of Ukraine. And essentially what you have here is a combination, I would say, of a second and a third generation internet control, which is quite fascinating because on the one hand, this artificial disinformation campaign using Twitter bots is a third generation control because it directly competes with the opposition and the message of the opposition in cyberspace. But at the same time, this stuff peaked and intensified during key political events. Nemtsov assassination, the Euromaidan crisis, armed rebellions by pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. So you have a very, very clever combination working here to make the Russians believe what the Kremlin was saying, be it about Nemtsov, be it about Euromaidan, be it about its constant denying of support for the pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. And again, the perhaps the annexation of Crimea is another big one, because that was also sort of extensively tweeted about by the opposition, and in response, these pro-Kremlin Twitter bots flooded the opposition with messages of the fact that it was a justified annexation, or rather reconnection of Russia and the long-lost peninsula of Crimea.
Did this information have much impact on Russian public opinion at the end of the day? Are they successful in convincing the public to side with Putin on his policies?
Absolutely, and this is where stuff gets real scary. Because what I've been talking about here, and in my thesis, just, you know, to remind you, I'm talking about three ways that the government has sought to compete with the opposition online and to rein in the internet, really. One is changing the legal framework, these structural changes, bloggers' law, foreign agents' law, that stuff. Two is attempting to nationalize, as you said, social media and news websites by ousting independent and oppositionally minded either owners or news editors and replacing them with pro-Kremlin figures. So directly acquiring indirect control. And three, the online response, Twitter bots and internet trolls. And the impact on public opinion has been real and measurable. So again, to backtrack a little bit, there's been research done on this 2011 Duma election protests. And scholars found, after the election came to an end, that greater use of the internet led to perceiving the election in 2011 as having been conducted unfairly. By contrast, TV viewers were more likely to think that the election was conducted in a fair and transparent, non-fraudulent manner. So back in 2011, you had this clear divide between those who primarily watched TV and got their news from there, who thought that the election was fair and that United Russia did win a majority and there was no need for re-elections, and the more internet-savvy chunk of Russia's population, who were not comfortable with the idea of United Russia seizing an electoral majority in the State Duma because of how many instances of electoral fraud were documented. So you had this clear divide between traditional media in the form of newspapers and TV and the internet back in 2011. What is perhaps very shocking is that in a similar research, and here I mostly draw on data from the Levada Center, which is Russia's primary independent polling firm, the biggest one. They are pretty, you know, it's a pretty reliable source. At the end of 2015, actually, as I was doing my thesis, this report came out by Levada in December of 2015, where people were asked a number of important questions, such as, do you think Russia is likely will likely become a full-on consolidated dictatorship in the future? Do you think the opposition will be hounded to a greater extent in the future? Do you think that the government's fight against the so-called fifth column of the West and these foreign agents is justified? And do you think Russia is a democratic country? These questions were asked to the respondents by pollsters employed by Levada. And what is very interesting and what was extremely useful for my research purposes here is that the researchers controlled for the kind of media that the respondents primarily consumed. So essentially allowing me to look at what the Russians who primarily got their news from TV had to say on those four issues, and what people who primarily got their news and trusted the internet to a greater extent had to say about those same issues. And shockingly, very, very shockingly, there was essentially no difference. Just to remind you, in 2011, there was a clear dividing line. If you are an internet user, you're oppositionally minded. You're not a big fan of the status quo. If you stay at home and, you know, watch TV or mostly read newspapers, use traditional media, you're more likely to agree with the status quo. End of 2015, they did this poll. Essentially no difference. Whether you read more newspapers and watch more TV or you mostly use the internet, you are just as likely to, or rather, the same percentage or the same share of the population had to say certain things about prospects for democracy in Russia, the opposition being hounded to a greater extent in the future, and things of that sort. So this development is, once again, not only shocking, I keep using this word, just because of how much this shows the Kremlin, how much success the Kremlin has had in pushing the internet-savvy chunk of Russia's population in the direction of agreeing with the official message of the state. The domestic policy priorities of the Kremlin are to maintain stability, order, and limit criticism. And clearly, by using various methods to control who says what online and what kind of stuff people can read online, has helped the Kremlin convince the internet users of the Russian Federation, who are predominantly young professionals, that Russia is, you know, to a certain extent still a democratic country, that it will unlikely to become a full-on dictatorship in the future, and that the government's fight against the fifth column of the West and the foreign agents is justified. You know, the RUNET was once the last bastion of the very notion of free speech in Russia, and it looks like that might no longer be the case thanks to the various internet control mechanisms that the Kremlin has utilized since 2011. The RUNET is no longer, unfortunately, the place for relative freedom of expression and independent news that it once was, thanks to all these fascinating developments that I've been talking about.
That actually is really scary.
This concludes the third part of the interview series. In the next segment, we will be discussing Russia's online interference in other countries. Thank you for listening.